from your mouth, Lord, from your heart, not from our minds and not from our own sometimes corrupt lips, Lord. And just ask you to show your power, Lord, and to bring things forth that touch and move and speak of you, Lord, and reveal your heart to us. And just bless the rest of the time together, Lord, in Yeshua's name. So you want to come up, Judah?
Hello, everybody. So the one thing on my mind this morning is the Torah portion, because I read it for the second time, for the second week in the longest time, probably a year or more. So I'm on a roll. So this morning in our discussion, I tried to summarize the Torah portion, and that got a little lengthy. And I'm going to try to summarize it again with a little less, fewer words. So the Torah portion for this week is called Shelach Lecha. That is from Numbers chapter 13, verse 1 through chapter 15, verse 41. Basically, what happens in this Torah portion is God commands Moses to tell a leader from each of the tribes of Israel to go out into the land that God is giving them and to scout it out. And he gives them specific commands to do things like to assess, well, it's an assessment, basically, to look at the soil, to come back and say, is it rich or poor, to specifically to get samples of the various fruits that are around, and they come back with pomegranates, figs, and huge grapes. And God also tells them to, what else? Here it is, in verse 17 of chapter 13. When Moses sent them to scout the land of Canaan, he said to them, go up there into the Negev and on into the hill country and see what kind of country it is. Are the people who dwell in it strong or weak, few or many? Strong or weak, few or many? Is the country in which they dwell good or bad? Are the towns they live in open or fortified? Is the soil rich or poor? Is it wooded or not? He even says to come back and say if it's wooded or not. And take the pains to bring back some of the fruit of the land. Now it happened to be the season of the first grapes. So they do all this. They come back, and then they have this meeting time. There's a report given by these leaders of the people. The people are all around them. Moses and Aaron are there as well. And they give their assessment. And they say, well, there are these people there. They're called the Anakites. And it says that we saw the Nephilim there, and they give all these logistical, all this data, which is what God told them to do. They say, God said specifically, are they strong or are they weak? And I don't think they went beyond God's word to say that they were strong, or at least to give that that report. But what they do say is a lot more than what God told them to do. And so they say, the people are too much for us. And they give a bad report, and then there are two people, Caleb and Joshua, son of Nun, who was originally called Hosea, son of Nun, and Moses renamed him. And I don't think the Torah portion says why. And they give a good report saying, no, the Lord has given this land to us. And one of them even says, for they are our prey. And, you know, surely God will give them into our hand. And, you know, I think there's a little bit of back and forth in the meeting. And the people are, it says, the whole community threatened to pelt them with stones. The presence of the Lord appeared in the tent of the meeting to all the Israelites. Oh, and then what happens? God, for the bad report, God says that the punishment, the result of that is that they had to wander through the desert for 40 years. And on hearing that report, the people were grieved. And I think I remember hearing during the reading, another translation says they were depressed. But anyways, they wander through the desert, and the leaders who had given the bad report were, there was a plague that was sent on them, and they died immediately. And then another big important part of all of this is that Moses pleads to God for the people, and because God wants to just destroy all of them instantly. And he says, Moses says, but Lord, what will the nations who have heard you and know of your fame, what will they say when they hear that you have destroyed this people? And actually, I want to go right there because I wanted to focus on that a little. So, pardon me a moment. My mind is a little bit fuzzy here. Okay. Help me, Lord. Anyhow, you know what? I don't think I'm going to read it. So, where did I leave off? The leaders die from a plague, and then the last thing I said, if somebody can remind me, that would help. If not... Ah, thank you. Moses pleaded with God for the people and, you know, said, as I said, what will the nations think of this? And or specifically the people who have heard of your fame. And, and it's something about an oath is mentioned. And I can't quite understand it. Promised them on oath is the word. Let's see. It must, so this is what Moses says. Now, but Moses said to the Lord, when the Egyptians from whose midst you brought up this people in your might hear the news, they will tell it to the inhabitants of the land. Now they have heard that you, O Lord, are in the midst of this people, that you, O Lord, appear in plain sight when your cloud rests over them and when you go before them in a pillar of cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night. If then you slay this people to a man, the nations who have heard your fame will say, it must be because the Lord was powerless to bring that people into the land he had promised them on oath, that he had slaughtered them in the wilderness, Therefore, I pray, let my Lord's forbearance be great, as you have declared, saying, the Lord, slow to anger and abounding in kindness, forgiving iniquity and transgression. Now here I clearly see that Moses is not saying that God is not slow to anger and not abounding in kindness. But he's saying, what will the nations think? What will the outsider think who does not know that you are slow to anger and abounding in kindness and forgiving iniquity and transgression, yet not remitting all punishment? That's one of the biggest things that stuck out to me in this Torah portion is the not remitting all punishment. I see that later on, well, it goes on and says, pardon, I pray, the iniquity of this people according to your great kindness, as you have forgiven this people ever since Egypt. And so the Lord has forgiven all these people ever since Egypt, and yet he has not remitted all punishment. And I just find that, I don't know it was so novel to me about that, but maybe this idea out there or in my own head that if God forgives sin, that means there's no consequence. But obviously, according to the, no, maybe not obviously, I shouldn't say that. I've been told not to say that by wise people. But if you look at the scriptures and you see it clearly, here in this Torah portion, God, I mean, he puts, there's a plague that goes on the leader. So there are these leaders who are giving this bad confession, whose hearts are turned against God. And that was one of the other thing I wanted to bring out is that Moses says, only you must not rebel against the Lord in chapter 14, verse 9. And boy, did they rebel against the Lord. The community threatens the group. It says here in verse 10, the same chapter, as the whole community threatened to pelt them with stones, the presence of the Lord appeared in the tent of meeting to all the Israelites. And so I think that clearly shows the state of their heart. And the state of the heart of Caleb and Joshua is so very different. I see that I was saying in the discussion earlier that it's just, you know, there are people, there are believers, maybe all of us are capable of doing this. We can just, you know, shoot off our mouth and say, yeah, you know, the Lord is able, and we have all these, you know, the spiritual high, and maybe it's a good thing, the spiritual high, and you know, we've read scripture and we're so convinced, we're like, oh, the Lord is so good, and God can do it. But while I think that these two faithful leaders of the Israelites, of the clans of the Israelites, had that same intensity, I think it came from a different place, and it wasn't just enthusiasm, human enthusiasm. It really came from a faith given them from God. And it's clear because one of the things I think what I mentioned before is that one of the people said, you know, they were like, they'll be like prey to us. You know, basically, the Lord is so great, we're gonna eat them alive. And that's another thing, as bad as that sounds, these are the people of God doing the work of God. And there was an obstacle in their way, and these people weren't just going to give up the land that God was giving to them because they, you know, they said, oh, hey, our God says this is our land, so head out. And actually what happened is sorry to some continue the summary, what ends up happening is the people of God say, oh, we were wrong, Lord, sorry. And they go into the land in their own strength, and they, without Moses and without the support of God, and they get destroyed. And what ends up happening is Moses who says, the Lord says, what's going to happen is, your wives and your children who you prophesied, basically they prophesied, that they will be enslaved to the people who of the land that you're going into, and at the same time they're saying, we're going to be slain, and our wives and our children are going to be taken. Those children and those wives are the ones who are going into the land, and you're going to die in the wilderness in the 40 years that I have you walking there. And so, again, it goes back to the, does not remit the all punishment. And God allows them and allows the children to suffer, the children and the wives to suffer from the sin of these people. So that's just one thing. I think I have a lot on my mind, and it's so it's nice to sit down and just read this and think about it, because there's so many good little nuggets of truth that come from it when you sit down and read it. And that's really what I want to do, is get these little nuggets out that I thought I saw in when I was reading. The one thing, I guess there is, I do have a point to this message, and there were some things I wrote down that I'll just say now. I'll just read what I wrote. It is not that God told the Israelites not to assess the land. It is that they were not told to base their conclusions on the assessment. And so God has them go in and says, basically take samples of the soil, see if it's fertile. See if the people is strong or weak. Look at all of it, And in that I kind of see a lesson for all of us in life. God does not tell us not to think. Faith does not mean absence of thought. And God tells us to to live circumspectly is one of the scriptures says. And what I believe that means is, I heard in another teaching that means to look around you. You need to be, aware of all of it. Circumspect is the word. And so they were to assess the land, see what's positive, what's negative, what's strong, weak, fertile, not fertile. And they come back with lots of good things, apart from the bad report. They come back with pomegranates, figs, and huge grapes. That means the land is really fertile. And, they do say, surely it is flowing with milk and honey. And then they give their bad report. Maybe I have that backwards. But in any case, I think the lesson for us in life, maybe one little lesson, is that God is telling us to think, but we are not supposed to prophesy on our own lives or on others' lives based on the things that we see and the conclusions the natural conclusions that we would come to based on seeing the evidence. And there are things in all of our lives that we need to conquer and destroy, just like the Israelites had to conquer and destroy things that were keeping them from attaining what God had promised them. And one thing that God wants us to pursue holiness. And so if we just apply this message to that part of our lives, there are things that obstacles and sin and things that we need to destroy in our lives that come in the way of us taking a hold of the promises of God. And I think the message for all of us is that there is, we're not supposed to look, we can assess and say, this sin is big, or this sin is small. And maybe the soil of your life is very, very poor. Maybe it's really rich. I think in God we have really rich soil. We have really rich opportunities in Jesus, in Yeshua. And that's something that's really big. And you know, we can base our conclusions on that very thing, and that doesn't come from a natural human thinking. That comes from a God type of thinking that doesn't take the data that we collect and it doesn't take our circumstances. It takes them into account, but doesn't take them view them in such a way that we base our conclusions, the conclusions and predict. Sorry, we base our conclusions. And predict results for our lives based on those things. So what I'm trying to say, if I'm not clear, is let's have faith in what in God's power and concern ourselves with God's power in our lives and believe for it and let's not say that we're grasshoppers, like Israel said. You know, we're really small here today. I don't normally speak. We're very, very small here today, and that's an assessment, and it's a fact. But that's not the way God sees us, and you know, I struggle with things in my life, and I'm going to declare that God is bigger than the big obstacles in my life and the big sins and the small sins. And I'm not a grasshopper as small as I am. And God is able. There's a passage that was read earlier about listening in faith, and I think that's also related to this, that we can listen to the data and the assessments, and but I don't think that we should the listening in faith, I think, is key. Listen to it, but believe what God says for the circumstances that you are in, whether they are difficult or not difficult. There was a little more I had to say. How much time do you need to speak, Mr. King? Okay. I just had one other thing. So the other part of the Torah portion is actually not about about Caleb and Joshua and everything that happened there. It's a little more about law and what Israel should be doing. And I just wanted to look at that. I have some thoughts churning in me and calling, I believe, God is churning in me for the nations and for foreigners and for and I just see some really cool things in the Torah portion. So I wanted to bring them out. Anyhow, chapter 14, verse 15. In Numbers, chapter 14, verse 15. Sorry, I'm coming to it. That is not where I want it to be. Okay. 14, 15. That could be. Maybe I'm just reading this wrong. 14, 15. Well, let's see. Yeah, thank you. So this is what it says. And when, throughout the ages, a stranger who has taken up residence with you or one who lives among you would present a gift of pleasing odor to the Lord, as you do, so shall it be done by the rest of the congregation. There shall be one law for you and for the resident stranger. It shall be a law for all time throughout the ages. You and the stranger shall be alike before the Lord. The same ritual and the same rule shall apply to you and to the stranger who resides among you. And I read that and I was just thinking, is God not the God of the Gentiles? Or is God the God only of the Jews? And this is Paul speaking, and I'm not quoting him perfectly, but he says, well, I'm not quoting him, period. He's saying, is God not only the God of the Jews, but also of all the nations, of all the Gentiles? Of course he is. And I tie that into what it is, what it says here, and it just is pretty amazing to me that God views us as part of one family in him, and also emphasizing that there shall be one law for the resident stranger. And of course this is in the time of Israel, and I don't claim to be a follower of Jewish law, but I think this what this speaks to me is that God has a heart for all people, and maybe I guess that's really all. Maybe you know this. It was also interesting. I wanted to point out that it says the strangers who defiantly revile the Lord will be cut off from his people. And so there's a place there that talks about. Normally, when I've read that, I thought of Israel. Israel being cut off, but not the stranger among Israel. It's just so interesting how God doesn't change. God is not just the God of the Jews, but of the Gentiles only. Of the Gentiles as well. I think I'm just going to stop talking. And I do mean that. I'm going to leave it at that. And it says in chapter 15, verse 19. Verse 29. For the citizen among the Israelites and for the stranger who resides among them, you shall have one ritual for everyone who acts in error. And so, maybe that wasn't the best ending place, but I hope you got something from that. And thank you for listening.
As we read through the Torah portion in the back and talked about it a little bit together, you know, what struck me, I'm going to start by going a little outside this week's readings into 2 Corinthians 5, right? What hit me was this. For we know that if the earthly tent which is our house, is torn down. We have a building from God, a house not made with hands, eternal in the heavens. For indeed in this house we groan, longing to be clothed with our dwelling from heaven, inasmuch as we, having put it on, will not be found naked. For indeed while we are in this tent, we groan, being burdened, because we do not want to be unclothed, but to be clothed, so that what is mortal will be swallowed up by life. Now he who prepared us for this very purpose is God, who gave to us the Spirit as a pledge. Therefore, being always of good courage, and knowing that while we are at home in the body, we are absent from the Lord, for we walk by faith, not by sight. We are of good courage, I say, and prefer rather to be absent from the body and to be at home with the Lord. So it's that phrase, you know, we walk by faith, not sight. And I, you know, when I read the story of the spies, you know, checking out the land, Moses tells them to go up there into the Negev, go up into the hill country, see what the land is like and whether the people who live in it are strong or weak, whether they are few or many. How is the land in which they live? Is it good or bad? And how are the cities in which they live? Are they like open camps or with fortifications? How is the land? Is it fat or lean? Are there trees in it or not? Make an effort then to get some of the fruit of the land. I don't think Moses is telling them that the key to our victory in the land is to know what challenges the land presents and how we are going to overcome them. I think this is a test to show Israel whether they are living and walking by faith or by sight. And what you see between the two different reports is Joshua and Caleb come back and they give a report that shows that they are walking by faith. And the others, they give a report that shows that they're walking by sight, right? They talk about how big things are and how they can't overcome them because of how big they are. And everything is in the physical. Everything is in, you know, the dauntingness of the sights they see. And whereas Caleb says, you know, we should by all means go up and take possession of it, for we will surely overcome it. But the men who had gone up with him said, we are not able to go up against the people, for they are too strong for us. So they gave out to the sons of Israel a bad report of the land which they had spied out, saying, the land through which we have gone in spying it out is a land that devours its inhabitants, and all the people whom we saw in it are men of great size. There also we saw the Nephilim, and we became like grasshoppers in our own sight. So we were in their sight. So, you know, unlike the rest of the other 10 leaders who saw, you know, who were contrasting their own strength with the strength of the people that they were seeing in the land, you know, that wasn't where Caleb or Joshua were coming from, right? They were talking about the land which we passed through to spy out is an exceedingly good land. If the Lord is pleased with us, then he will bring us into this land and give it to us, a land which flows with milk and honey. Only do not rebel against the Lord and do not fear the people of the land, for they will be our prey. Their protection has been removed from them, and the Lord is with us. Do not fear them. And all the congregation says to stone them with stones. And it just shows, you know, this is God showing, bearing the heart of Israel and bearing to them the fact that this current generation, except with few exceptions, is walking by sight, not walking by faith. And I think it's very clear. There are lots of illustrations in the Bible. I'll go through a couple more quickly. That, you know, we do not possess the land that God lays before us unless we walk by faith. God is not looking for a people who walk by sight. He's not looking for a people who can see, who tackle only challenges that they see that in their own strength they can overcome. And if we try to do that, I believe God will show us our weaknesses. If we instead are cognizant of our weaknesses but very aware of God's strength, God will show us his power. And you know, another example that just always inspires me is in 1 Samuel 17 with David and Goliath. And we talked about this a little bit in the back as well. But I'll just read through a little bit as an illustration. 1 Samuel 17. I won't read it all, but I'll start with. Then a champion came out from the armies of the Philistines named Goliath from Gath, whose height was 6 cubits and a span. He had a bronze helmet on his head, and he was clothed with scale armor, which weighed 5,000 shekels of bronze. He also had bronze greaves on his legs and a bronze javelin slung between his shoulders. The shaft of his spear was like a weaver's beam, and the head of his spear weighed 600 shekels of iron. His shield carrier also walked before him. He stood and shouted to the ranks of Israel and said to them, "Why do you come out to draw up in battle array? Am I not the Philistine and you servants of Saul? Choose a man for yourselves and let him come down to me." Now he's trying to change the conditions of the battle, just like, here, we're going to send forth the mighty me. Now you come up with someone who's as mighty as me and send him out to challenge me. And he says, you know, if he is able to fight with me and kill me, then we will become your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then you shall become our servants and serve us. Again, the Philistine said, "I defy the ranks of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together." When Saul and all Israel heard these words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. Very like the spies, right? I mean, they see the challenge. They're wilting in the face of the challenge because they're looking at it from a position of their own strength. But David was the son of the Ephrathite of Bethlehem in Judah, whose name was Jesse. And Jesse had 8 sons. And Jesse was old in the days of Saul, advanced in years among men. The 3 older sons of Jesse had gone after Saul to the battle. And the names of his 3 sons who went to the battle were Eliab, the firstborn, and the second to him, Abinadab, and the 3rd, Shammah. David was the youngest. Now the 3 oldest followed Saul, but David went back and forth from Saul to tend his father's flock at Bethlehem. The Philistine came forward morning and evening for 40 days. Interesting, 40 days. 40 days, the spies searched out the land. 40 days, the Philistine came out and taunted Israel. "None of you can stand before me." Then Jesse said to David, his son, "Take now for your brothers an ephah of this roasted grain and these 10 loaves and run to the camp to your brothers." So David wasn't even looking for this challenge, right? He just sent there. And then he observes something that he finds deeply disturbing. "Bring also these 10 cuts of cheese to the commander and their 1,000 and look into the welfare of your brothers and bring back news of them." That he wasn't even thought worthy to battle with Israel, being a young boy against the Philistine army, let alone to challenge Goliath. "For Saul and they and all the men of Israel are in the valley of Elah, fighting with the Philistines." So David arose early in the morning and left the flock with a keeper and took the supplies and went as Jesse had commanded him. And he came to the circle of the camp while the army was going out in battle array, shouting the war cry. Israel and the Philistines drew up in battle array, army against army. Then David left his baggage in the care of the baggage keeper and ran to the battle line and entered in order to greet his brothers. As he was talking with them, behold, the champion, the Philistine from Gath, named Goliath, was coming up from the army of the Philistines, and he spoke these same words, and David heard them. Excuse me for just a second. I'm just going to blow my nose here. And David heard them. When all the men of Israel saw the man, they fled from him and were greatly afraid. This is because they were walking in sight, right? I mean, you know, clearly in their own strength, not one of them could go and defeat the mighty Goliath, right? The men of Israel said, "Have you seen this man who is coming up? Surely he is coming up to defy Israel, and it will be that the king will enrich the man who kills him with great riches and will give him his daughter and make his father's house free in Israel." Then David spoke to the men. You know, he's just a young boy. He just doesn't understand how these people are acting. But he's a young boy with a great and simple faith, right? saying, "What will be done for the man who kills this Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should taunt the armies of the living God?" And the people answered him in accord with this word, saying, "Thus it will be done for the man who kills him." And so David goes forth. Saul hears his words, and David says to Saul, "Let no man's heart fail on account of him. Your servant will go and fight with this Philistine." So he had, the faith, he had the courage, and God supplied the rest. Then Saul said to David, "You are not able to go against this Philistine to fight with him, for you are but a youth while he has been a warrior from his youth." But David said to Saul, "Your servant was tending his father's sheep. When a lion or a bear came and took a lamb from the flock, I went out after him and attacked him and rescued it from his mouth. And when he rose up against me, I seized him by his beard." This is, by the way, just by way of passing, right? There's a phrase about bearding the lion, or bearding the lion and the lion's down. This is where that phrase comes from, right? "I seized him by his beard and struck him and killed him. Your servant," it expresses great courage to walk up to the lion and grab his beard in his in his own den. "Your servant has killed both the lion and the bear, and this uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them, since he has taunted the armies of the living God." And David said, "The Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion and from the paw of the bear," and see again, he's not making the claim in his own strength. He's not saying, "Because I am so mighty and can wrestle lions and bears, I can surely defeat this Philistine too." He says, "The Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion and from the paw of the bear, he will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine." Sounds very like Caleb and Joshua, son of Nun, right? Don't worry about the size of the enemy. Understand and believe in the power of God. And Saul said to David, "Go, and may the Lord be with you." And I bet Saul, when he said him, he was not expecting David to actually win the battle. But, there wasn't anyone else stepping forward. There's no evidence that Saul had the faith. But David, girded his sword over his armor and tried to walk, for he had not tested them. Because Saul clothed him with his garments and put a bronze helmet on his head, doing everything he can to protect David in the flesh, because he's not approaching this through faith like David is. And David took them off. He says, "I cannot go with these, for I have not tested them." Then he takes his stick in his hand and chooses for himself 5 smooth stones from the brook and puts them in the shepherd's bag. And his sling was in his hand, and he approached the Philistine. Then the Philistine came on and approached David with a shield bearer in front of him. When the Philistine looked and saw David, he disdained him, for he was but a youth and ruddy with a handsome appearance. And the Philistine said to David, "Am I a dog that you come to me with sticks?" And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. The Philistine also said to David, "Come to me, and I will give your flesh to the birds of the sky and the beasts of the field." Then David came to the Philistine, said to the Philistine, "You come to me with a sword, a spear, and a javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have taunted. This day the Lord will deliver you up into my hands, and I will strike you down and remove your head from you. And I will give the dead bodies of the army of the Philistines this day to the birds of the sky and the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel. All this assembly may know that the Lord does not deliver by sword or by spear. For the battle is in the Lord's hand, and he will give you into our hands." And so it happens, right? David prevails over the Philistine with a sling and a stone. And, similarly, Rahab, Rahab expresses faith when she speaks in Joshua 2. And then I'll stop. I'll briefly mention Peter walking on the water as well. But Rahab in Joshua 2, she shows them her own faith and also the effect that the actions of God have had on the hearts and the resolve of the people facing them, right? Before they lay down on the roof, she came up to them on the roof, and said to the man, I know that the Lord has given you the land, and that the terror of you has fallen on us, and that all the inhabitants of the land have melted away before you. They have become as prey, so to speak. For we have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea before you when you came out of Egypt. Now, here she is telling people, you know, it's like, so these are the men, the spies with the bad report in Numbers 13 and 14. They actually saw this. They saw this with their own eyes. They saw the Lord dry up the water, and they walked through the Red Sea on dry land. Rahab has only heard about it. You know, she's only heard of it. And she's seen the effects that the story has, and yet she believes it, right? And what you did to the two kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan, to Sihon and Og, whom you utterly destroyed. When we heard it, our hearts melted, and no courage remained in any man any longer because of you. For the Lord your God, he is God in heaven above and on earth beneath. Now, therefore, please swear to me by the Lord, since I have dealt kindly with you, that you will also deal kindly with me, and give me a pledge of truth, and spare my father and my mother and my brothers and my sisters. And, you know, we see also this question of, do we walk by sight or do we walk by faith in Matthew 14 when Yeshua comes out to the boat on the water and David sees him. Or not David, but Peter sees him. And Peter says to him, okay, so when the disciples saw him walking on the sea, they were terrified and said, it is a ghost. And they cried out in fear. But immediately Jesus spoke to them, saying, take courage, it is I. Do not be afraid. Peter said to him, Lord, if it is you, command me to come to you on the water. And Peter actually demonstrates his faith. Because Yeshua says, come, and Peter gets out of the boat, and he walks on the water and comes toward Jesus, and he's walking on the water. Clear evidence. He had the faith to do it, and the faith was, and God was recognizing and operating in that faith. But then seeing the wind, he became frightened. So, his eyes just veered from seeing in faith to seeing by sight. And he became frightened and began to sink, and he cried out, Lord, save me. And immediately Yeshua stretched out his hand and took hold of him and said to him, you of little faith, why did you doubt? And when they got into the boat, the wind stopped, and those who were in the boat worshipped him, saying, you are certainly God's son. So I think the battle is a matter of whether we respond with faith in God's, you know, whether we join the battle is a matter of whether, and whether we're ready to join the battle is whether we are depending on God. And so, you know, it occurred to me when people talked about Independence Day, you know, these things are about, in a way, they're about our Dependence Day, right? Dependence on God's power, not our independence in our own strength, our ability to take on these challenges. But when we assess these things, we should not be assessing them because we're trying to evaluate and figure out whether in our own strength we can do what God has commanded us to do. If God has commanded us to do something, He will provide the way to do it. And if we believe that and we walk in it and we don't let the particulars of our own, you know, rational assessment get in the way of God's miraculous power, then we too can go in and possess the land that God has set out for us to possess. We can displace the powers that will try to resist, and we can have the same victory that Joshua and Caleb and the generation that eventually, after 40 years in the desert, you know, eventually entered the land and subdued the land. So take heart, have courage, and remember that, you know, we walk by faith, not sight. So that's the question. Oh, you want to say?
Phone? All right. Okay. quite a few years ago, I was in this section of the Bible reading about Joshua. And after the spies came, when they finally came to actually, when Joshua finally came to take over the city, in Joshua 6, it says, let's see if I could find it, 6:17. It says, shout, for the Lord has given you the city. The city and all that is in it are to be devoted to the Lord. So when I first read that, that word devoted kind of jumped out at me. And at first I really didn't pay much attention to it. But as I went further in the book of Joshua, I came to the city of, how do you pronounce it, okay, let me put this here, I'll look for that. So in as he goes forth, for I have delivered, he talks about going into the city of Ai, for I have delivered it into your hands, for it has been devoted to me. Again, God says, it has been devoted to me. And by this time, I recognized that that particular word, devoted, was a very special word. And I really felt like the Lord gave me an insight in that the word devote, the root word of devote, is devour. So when you think about it, everything on earth is already devoted to God, right? So that particular word that's used in these sections I just mentioned, it means the total, irrevocable giving over of persons, places, or things as unto the Lord. Meaning, when God says this is devoted to me, that means there's no changing his mind. It's his, it belongs to him, and it's devoted to him. So I started to think about that, and I remember, it brought to mind how, you know, when we have kids, which will probably be happening soon, you know, you bring your baby into the service, and you want to dedicate your child to God. Well, when you dedicate something to God, you could take it back. You could buy it back. But if you devote your child to God, such as Samson was devoted to God, you can never, ever take it back. It's apparently very serious. So I went along reading that and everything, and what I realized was, again, everything that's already here, the whole earth is already devoted to God. It's either devoted to God's destruction or it's devoted to his glory, but it's devoted to him. And if you try to take it back, a good example of that would be, how do you pronounce his name? A-C-H-A-N. Achan? What's it? Huh? Yeah. He touched the devoted things. He took the devoted things. And he was destroyed from it because they really belonged to God. So it was not long after this came to my mind, I realized that I felt as if the Lord was saying to me, yeah, Joanne, you've dedicated things to me, but you've never devoted yourself to me or anything that you have. And he encouraged me to do that, and I did. So, but anyway, I just wanted to point out that the word, this particular word, means when God says it's totally devoted to me, because there's other words that mean devoted, but it's not that kind of devotion. So when you use this particular word, devotion, it means the total, irrevocable giving over of persons, places, or things as unto the Lord. So my challenge to everyone is, are you willing to devote yourself to the Lord? Meaning you could never turn back or turn away, and that you're totally given over unto him for his glory, not for his destruction. And that's basically all I have to share. Thank you.